From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Henry Zane.
And I'm Zoe Sinisklar.
This week on War News Radio, unconventional conflict.
First, we hear from a memoirist about her experiences as a military wife after 9/11.
Next, we present our editorial segment, Filibusted.
Then, we talk to an expert about civil resistance in Syria.
Finally, we find out what kind of college student supports drone strikes.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
According to an unidentified source in the Obama administration, Israeli warplanes bombed a military base in the Syrian port city of Latakia earlier this week. No casualties have been reported. The strike on a missile storage site targeted a shipment of Russian-made missiles and equipment to the Hezbollah militant group. A spokesperson for Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu denied Israeli involvement in the attack, saying, quote, "We have a practice of not commenting on these kinds of incidents when they arrive." This incident, however, comes after an unsuccessful Israeli strike on Latakia in July and marks the fifth attack allegedly carried out by Israeli forces against Syrian military bases this year.
A report by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or OPCW, announced this week that Syria has met the crucial deadline for the, quote, "functional destruction of equipment used to produce, mix, and fill chemical weapons." The Syrian government still possesses over 1,000 metric tons of lethal chemical agents that need to be disposed of by mid-2014. The OPCW inspected 21 of the 23 chemical weapons sites in Syria to oversee and verify the disposal of the critical equipment. Officials deemed the other two sites too dangerous to inspect because of their proximity to violence from the Syrian civil war.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad met with Lakhdar Brahimi, the United Nations Arab League envoy, earlier this week. Assad insisted that foreign support for the Syrian rebels must end in order for any political solution to be successful and lambasted those who aid the rebel forces. He stated that, quote, "The Syrian people are the only ones who have the right to decide on Syria's future." These comments, along with his calls for rebel disarmament as a precondition to negotiation, have threatened to jeopardize the planned peace talks in Syria next month.
The World Health Organization confirmed this week that 10 children in the Deir al-Zor province of northeastern Syria tested positive for polio. The diagnosis has sparked fears of a wider outbreak of the disease in the war-torn country, which has not seen cases of polio in over 14 years. Following the WHO announcement, the United Nations introduced plans to immunize millions of children in Syria, as well as in Egypt, Iraq, Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey, all countries with large Syrian refugee populations. Despite the, quote, "setback" of the polio outbreak, health officials have expressed optimism that vaccination efforts will prove successful in halting its spread. In countries like Afghanistan, Nigeria, and Pakistan, where polio has historically been endemic, similar vaccination procedures have drastically decreased the number of polio cases reported each year.
Chinese authorities confirmed that a car crash that left 2 dead and 40 injured near Tiananmen Gate this week was a terrorist attack. 2 suspects were arrested 5 hours after the incident, and at least one has confessed to involvement in the attack. Police have characterized the attack as, quote, "carefully planned, organized, and premeditated," and reported that they found gasoline, knives, and a, quote, "flag with extremist content" in the vehicle used in the attack. Suspects have been identified as Uyghurs, a Muslim ethnic minority in China. More than 100 Uyghurs were recently arrested for allegedly promoting jihadist ideals online, and an anti-terrorism raid in the Xinjiang region killed at least 12 people and injured at least 20 in August. Members of the Uyghur community fear that this latest attack will prompt even greater discrimination against a small minority group.
Troops backed by United Nations forces in the Democratic Republic of Congo drove M23 rebels from Bunagana, a town at the country's eastern border. The defeat of the insurgents was the result of several days of intense fighting in the region following failed peace talks this week. The M23 rebellion first emerged in the spring of 2012 after leaders of CNDP, a previous insurgent group, claimed that the Congolese army breached this agreement to integrate CNDP fighters into national forces. The defeat in Bunagana came as a major victory for the Congolese government, which has been fighting to regain control of the region since August of this year. According to UN experts, Rwanda has helped arm and fund the M23 movement, and future stability in the area may largely depend on whether the neighboring country continues to support the insurgent group.
Egyptian security forces arrested Esame Erien, one of the last remaining leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood, earlier this week. Erien served as a senior official for the political branch of the Brotherhood and advised President Mohamed Morsi before the July coup ousted the Islamist regime. After 26 attempts to apprehend Erien, police finally captured him days before the start of Morsi's trial. Both Erien and Morsi will face charges of inciting violence against the state for their alleged role in the murder of protesters last December. Protests broke out at an Egyptian university following the announcement of Erien's arrest, as pro-Muslim Brotherhood students smashed windows, destroyed campus property, and graffitied an administrative building. These clashes between members of the army and pro-Morsi forces have become a near daily occurrence. At least 1,000 Morsi supporters have been killed, and over 6,000 have been arrested since the regime's overthrow.
45 people were killed after a crowded bus collided with a highway barrier and caught fire in southern India earlier this week. 7 people managed to escape the blaze, though the driver and his assistant were arrested after fleeing the scene of the accident. Many of the remains were burned beyond recognition, and local police units have gathered DNA samples to identify the deceased passengers. Car crashes are tragically common occurrences in India. The nation has the highest annual deaths from car crashes of any country in the world. According to police reports, more than 110,000 individuals die from car crashes in India every year because of reckless driving, poor quality roads, and overcrowding.
A suicide bomber in the Tunisian resort town of Sousse detonated explosives in his backpack earlier this week, killing himself but causing no other casualties. In the nearby city of Monastir, an 18-year-old carrying a backpack full of TNT was caught following a group of tourists in the mausoleum of Habib Bourguiba, Tunisia's founder. None were harmed in the incident, and the motives of both men remain unclear. Suicide bombings have been uncommon in Tunisia despite increased turmoil and violence following the ouster of Tunisia's former president, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, in the Arab Spring. In 2002, Ben Ali cracked down on terrorism after Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists bombed a popular Tunisian synagogue and tourist destination. Tunisia, which welcomes over 1 million tourists annually, relies heavily upon the success of its tourism industry, and these attempted bombings have endangered this crucial sector of the economy.
A group of high-profile senators sent a letter to United States President Barack Obama before his meeting with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, urging Obama to push Maliki to, quote, formulate a comprehensive political and security strategy that can stabilize the country. The senators, including Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and John McCain of Arizona, called for Obama to increase counterterrorism support for Iraq and press Maliki to break ties with Iran. Maliki, however, has stated that Iran needs American weapons and intelligence in order to combat terrorist threats. While Obama has applauded Maliki's efforts to secure peace in Iraq, many experts have blamed Maliki's poor leadership for the recent influx of violence in the region.
The Pakistani Ministry of Defense stated this week that only 3% of the deaths from United States drone strikes have been civilian casualties. Of the 2,227 individuals who have died in 317 U.S. drone strikes, Pakistan claimed that only 67 were not members of Islamic militant groups. These most recent figures were at odds with previous reports by the Pakistani government. Earlier this month, the Pakistani Foreign Ministry told the United Nations at least 400 civilians have been killed by drones since 2004. Finding exact figures for civilian casualties, however, remains challenging. The classified nature of the U.S. drone program, as well as the remote locations of many strikes, make it difficult to determine the victims of drone violence.
This is War News Radio. This past September marked the 12th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks that shook America to its core. Like most tragedies in American history, the attack and the ensuing war on terror in Iraq and Afghanistan have left an indelible impression on artists across the country, prompting them to reflect on the effects of war on both the soldiers that fight it and the loved ones they leave behind. Amelie Flynn has emerged as one such artist who writes poetry in an attempt to document, process, and share the lived experiences of those fighting on the front lines of both the war front and the home front. War News Radio's Patrick Hahn reports.
I will turn the lights on and then off. in a kitchen, in a hallway, or in our bedroom, where my husband will sit up and turn to me, saying, "Why?" But first I turn off the radio in this car, turn it off, the news in this darkness, and turn off the war. The one they say is almost over.
That was a reading from Turns, a poem by American writer Amalie Flynn, as read by Amy DiPiero. Like much of Flynn's poetry, it provides a unique window into the lived experiences of a wife at war.
I'm saying something intimate in my poetry about war and what war does. And then I'm also saying something more global. And what I mean by that is I'm sharing my story as a military wife.
Flynn's journey as a writer began with her two poetry blogs, Wife and War and September 11th, which have garnered international attention. Wife and War is also the name of her new book, a memoir of her experiences as a witness of the 9/11 terrorist attacks and the wife of a soldier serving in Iraq.
My book, Wife and War, the memoir, is my story. It's my story of witnessing the terror attacks on 9/11 and of years later marrying a man in the military, of how he survived his 15-month deployment to Afghanistan, and then how he endured the aftermath when war followed my husband home and created battlefields we did not expect.
Even now, 12 years after the events that inspired her poetry, Flynn's message of connection and global understanding is still relevant to readers.
But the poems seem to resonate with people from all around the world. And what that tells me is that they're really about humanity, about our shared humanity, about the experiences we all have, the connections we all make, and how fragile they are, how fragile the connections are, how they can be disconnected by conflict, and what it takes to mend them.
Flynn has always been a writer. For a long time, she has been using words and poetry to process and comment on the world around her.
You know, I was a writer before the war happened or before 9/11 happened, and I'll always be a writer. So I write what compels me to write. You know, that said, I think it is a way for me to understand or to make sense of things.
Since she witnessed the effects of the 9/11 terrorist attacks and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, war has become the most important source of inspiration for writing.
Obviously, my experience as a witness to the 9/11 terror attacks, of standing on the corner and then running for safety after the towers began to fall, that weaves its way through the narrative of my poems and the narrative of my book. But there's also hope, just as much as there's focus on disconnection or death and destruction. There's hope in my poems. There's hope in my books, and there's a lot of themes of reconnection and growth.
One of the aspects of war that Flynn focuses on as a military wife is the challenge faced by returning military personnel trying to reintegrate into American society.
I say in my book, Wife and War, the memoir, I say that being at war is hard, but coming home can be harder. And I really believe that's true, not just for us, but for so many military couples. Reintegration can be hard because war creeps into the most intimate moments in life. Ultimately, I'm expressing a reality of war that even in its most graceful or kindest form, it leaves its mark.
Flynn documents the more subtle challenges brought about by war. She focuses especially on how war takes a particularly heavy toll on the families of military personnel who face not just deployment, but repeated cycles of reintegration.
Troops are still in Afghanistan. We're still there. And even when we leave, you know, from an American perspective, for the returning soldiers, for veterans, their loved ones, for many of them, you know, the war is just beginning. You know, those coming home with you know, physical marks of war that I discussed earlier, such as lost limbs or TBI or PTSD or challenges reintegrating, war is still with them, and they're still facing the challenges of war.
Although her writing focuses on the American wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, her audience is global. Our blogs are read by readers from over 90 countries. This testifies to the universality of our message, which speaks to a humanity shared by people across the world.
It's speaking to the idea of a global family, how we're all part of one global family, and what our responsibilities are to one another, to, you know, tell each other our stories, to listen to one another, to act kindly and with understanding.
Flynn's writing spans not only geographic differences, but also differences in background.
I've had the privilege of hearing feedback from readers, and what always strikes me is that while so many military wives tell me that I'm giving a voice to their experience, I've had soldiers and veterans tell me the same, but also non-military readers tell me that the work is giving a voice to their own experiences.
Flynn believes that war stems from the way we abstract each other and think of each other in abstract terms. She has seen firsthand the devastation that attends war, and yet she is driven by hope for the future.
But I also believe that there is hope, and that the hope is in all of us sharing our stories and listening to one another's stories, across political divide, across the globe, and really that act of conversation and dialogue is what we need to show ourselves and to show each other how connected we are, and that we have, you know, responsibilities to one another to be kind and to be peaceful and to be understanding.
Overall, Flynn emphasizes that although her writing speaks to what she has seen, heard, and felt, the themes of her poetry extend far beyond her own personal experience.
I say often that my book, Wife and War, the memoir, is not just my story, but it's our story. All of us living in this global family, living in a time of war. And I believe it's our responsibility, each of us, to actively engage with the narrative of war, to humanize war, and to know and to respond to what it does on an intimate, individual level. And so sharing my writing with so many readers through my blogs and through my book allows me to live this philosophy, the philosophy of having obligations to one another, of peace and kindness and understanding, and to the philosophy of being connected.
Flynn's new book, Wife and War, the Memoir, is available in print and ebook, while our two blogs, Wife and War and September 11th, can be found on WordPress. You can join the conversation with Flynn on Facebook, Twitter, Goodreads, and Pinterest. For War News Radio, with Colin Smith, I'm Patrick Hahn.
This is War News Radio. Sometimes it's hard to read the news without getting angry. Caroline Batten and Will Sullivan have stopped trying. War News Radio proudly presents Filibusted, an editorial segment dedicated to news that makes us tear our hair out.
So Russian President Vladimir Putin didn't win the Nobel Peace Prize.
Which is a real shocker, especially if you live in Georgia or Chechnya.
And instead, the prize went to the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, the group currently investigating Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's arsenal.
You would think this would send a pretty clear message to Assad. The people trying to take away your weapons win a world popularity contest. Your most powerful international ally loses.
And after 2.5 years of fighting his own people, you'd also think he might want to consider negotiation.
But Assad supporters take note. If you want to negotiate on behalf of your government, you're going to get fired.
Yep. Syrian Deputy Prime Minister Ghadri Jamil was dismissed from his post for being a diplomat.
Jamil had been meeting with Russian and American officials in recent weeks. He said it was an attempt to end the bloodshed and broker a diplomatic solution.
But Assad fired him for, get this, spending too much time outside of Syria.
So a diplomat gets fired for going to other countries to negotiate deals? You'd really think international travel would be part of the job description, but apparently no one's told Assad that your diplomats are supposed to engage in diplomacy.
Too bad Jamil is one of Assad's biggest supporters. He insists that Assad can't be allowed to step down.
So here we have a minister who insists that Assad stay in power, and he actually gets a diplomatic audience with the U.S. And then Assad fires him? This is good strategy. How exactly?
Speaking of good international strategy, Russia and the United States aren't exactly in a stellar position to criticize Assad's diplomatic choices.
An Italian newspaper, Corriere della Sera, is accusing Russia of illegally recording delegates at the last G20 summit in St. Petersburg.
The paper says that the Russians gave the delegates free phone chargers and flash drives that were bugged.
Compromised iPhone plugs aside, Russia's presidential spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the charges were totally false and that they're just a distraction from the really big monitoring scandal. Everyone's favorite busybodies, the National Security Agency.
So, Russia is trying to deflect attention away from itself by saying this is a way for the United States to deflect attention away from itself?
Yep. But to be fair, the U.S. has a whole lot it would like to shove under the rug right now. The NSA has apparently been tapping German Chancellor Angela Merkel's cell phone for the past 10 years.
Were cell phones even around 10 years ago?
This news has sent Europe into a bit of a tizzy. Germany's obviously not happy. And now it's even looking like the European Union might halt trade negotiations with the United States.
There is one group that doesn't mind seeing the White House scrambling to cover their buttocks.
That would be Congress, which is very happy to no longer be the country's most hated government branch.
Multiple members of Congress have proudly pointed out that they aren't fans of the government spying on the country's allies.
Wow, Congress. You're so progressive. I'm so impressed. It's great to hear that you don't approve of the NSA allegedly monitoring over 60 million calls in Spain in a single month.
Wait, we actually did that? Yeesh.
So now the U.S. is working to establish a new bro code with nearly all of Europe.
Which is a foolproof plan, right? I mean, these unenforceable international agreements always go so well.
Prime example, you know how the United States has used drones to strike Pakistan?
And how Pakistan has repeatedly condemned the U.S. attacks?
Well, apparently that outrage was all for show, because the U.S. and Pakistan already have an agreement, in which the Pakistanis have endorsed the drone strikes for years.
International diplomacy in action.
But don't despair. Sheldon Adelson has the answer to all the United States foreign policy problems.
Yep. The billionaire conservative donor has the perfect plan for dealing with Iran's nuclear program. Fire an atomic bomb into the Iranian desert. As a warning shot.
Right. Because a bomb with a 50-mile blast radius is totally just a warning.
But Sheldon thinks it, quote, won't hurt a soul.
Nuclear weapons short out entire ecosystems. They make cities unlivable. They hurt lots and lots of souls. That's kind of what they're for.
Even North Korea hasn't launched an unprovoked nuclear missile at a land target. Come on, Sheldon. Do you really want to be the guy who's crazier than Kim Jong-un? And speaking of the dear leader, Kim's got a new pet project.
And it's not his budding bromance with Dennis Rodman.
He's building North Korea's first ever ski resort, and he's declared it a national priority.
According to the World Food Program, one-third of the children of North Korea are stunted due to malnutrition. And this is your national priority?
Wait, it gets better. Because of international sanctions on luxury goods, Kim can't get his hands on the parts needed to build ski lifts. He tried Austria, he tried France, he tried Switzerland. No one is going to sell him ski lifts.
So the North Korean government issues a statement saying that Switzerland's refusal to sell them ski lift parts is, wait for it, a serious violation of human rights.
Apparently, ski lifts are a human right. Food, not so much.
Yeah, you know what's really a serious violation of North Korea's rights? The actions of their government. But according to our buddy Kim, forced labor camps, widespread starvation, and complete isolation from international media are nothing compared to being deprived of your right to go skiing.
And if you're going to accuse another country, any other country, of human rights abuse, why, tell me why do you pick Switzerland of all places? What has Switzerland ever done aside from make lots of watches and stay neutral in every war?
But seriously, North Korea is one of the world's greatest offenders against human rights. Statements like Pyongyang's are painful and totally unacceptable.
Seriously, Kim, letting women wear shorter skirts now and then is not going to cut it, and you know it. You're expensively educated. You lived outside your country for years. You lived in Switzerland.
Which leaves us to wonder whether he's actually delusional or just putting it on for giggles.
Well, continuing with this month's list of human rights abuses.
This is the song that never ends.
Kuwait has decided to impose stricter medical tests on expatriates trying to enter the country. But this isn't a test for meningitis or malaria. It's a test for homosexuality.
Yep. Kuwait is convinced that its gaydar is so advanced, immigration health centers will be able to figure out who's homosexual and who's not.
Kuwaiti Health Ministry official Yusuf Mindkar says Kuwait is taking, quote, stricter measures on routine medical checks of expatriates in order to, quote, detect gays.
How do you detect gays? Does the health ministry have a rainbow-painted backscatter that flashes warning lights if you like same-sex lovin'?
Yeah, there's definitely no medical test for homosexuality, so I have no idea what kind of stricter measures Mindkar means.
Maybe he's just into S&M.
Since the thought of that makes me want to go hitch a ride on Adelson's nuclear bomb, let's move on. The U.S. has found a great new way to scare Somali pirates away from our mercantile ships.
Which is weird, because we're inviting them to...
The U.S. Merchant Navy blasts Britney Spears music to scare off pirates.
Well, technically, they use a long-range acoustic device to blast music at an unbearable volume. Like, frequencies loud enough to shut down riots.
And Britney just happens to be the tune of choice.
I guess if we used Miley Cyrus, we'd be violating the Geneva Convention.
Good point. For Filibusted, I'm Will Sullivan, in for Sarah Morrell.
And I'm Caroline Batten.
A big shout out to our producer, Tyler Welsh.
It's been a pleasure. At least for us.
This is War News Radio. While much of the focus of the conflict in Syria has been on violent tactics used by the opposition movement, armed resistance is not the only choice. Many highlight the success and strength of the nonviolent tactics used in the beginning months of the conflict. War News Radio's Sabrina Merrill spoke to Dr. Steven Zunes, an expert on U.S. Middle East policy and strategic nonviolent action.
There isn't a single armed Syrian resistance movement. It's fractured. It includes over 1,000 different militias, sincere nationalists, and extremists directly affiliated with al-Qaeda. But it didn't start that way. The resistance movement in the over 2.5-year Syrian civil war was initially a nonviolent and non-sectarian movement with a broad support base. Although the nonviolent opposition faced severe violent repression from the Syrian regime, for a time the movement was able to maintain nonviolent strategies. The Syrian regime is currently still violently repressing the opposition, but now the opposition is an armed and sectarian movement. Civilian deaths have increased and participant support has decreased. Maybe it doesn't have to end that way. Would the Syrian opposition movement be able to strategically transition back to nonviolent strategies of resistance? And if so, would the movement be successful? Dr. Steven Zunes believes both are possible.
I do think on pragmatic and utilitarian grounds, there will be this recognition that they're actually doing better, despite the repression. During the nonviolent phase of the movement, they had more people were involved. There were a higher rate of defections from the Syrian regime. They had more sympathy internationally. And that, just as a strategic choice, it would be a lot more sense. They'd have a much greater chance of bringing down Assad and creating a more representative, pluralistic Syria.
That's Dr. Steven Zunes, a professor of politics and international studies and the chair of the program in Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. As an expert on U.S. Middle East policy and strategic nonviolent action, Zunes understands the Syrian opposition movement faces many obstacles in bringing down the Syrian regime. In Libya, Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown by violent civil war. In Tunisia and Egypt, Ben Ali and Hosni Mubarak were deposed nonviolently. But in all three of these conflicts, the opposition movement only faced the power of a single ruler. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is the head of a powerful oligarchy comprised of head military officers, social elites, and Ba'ath Party officials, with a presence in almost every neighborhood. But Zuna says that just makes violent rebellion a bad strategy.
Because if you're fighting a government that has a relatively broad base of support, you need to get even broader base of support. And what nonviolent action has shown repeatedly is that you get more people involved in the struggle. You take advantage of where you have the power, that is the numbers, and not where the regime has the power in their use of military force.
Zunas recognizes the Syrian regime has used credible force and severe repression against protesters, gunning down nonviolent demonstrators using snipers and helicopter gunships. At the same time, the strength of the nonviolent resistance lies in its ability to maintain nonviolent behavior, even when met with violent repression. In order to survive repression from the Syrian regime, Zuna says the nonviolent movement must look beyond simply leading demonstrations and strategically choose nonviolent resistance that does not expose protesters on the street.
The nonviolent movement would need to figure out what are the pillars of the support of the regime. The Ba'ath Party, the crony capitalists that the regime has developed, etc. How do you target those, you know, strikes and boycotts against the crony capitalists and others that support the regime, in many ways withholding one's support. And indeed, there were a number of successful general strikes that really that shut down much of the country, that really sent a very powerful message. If they could build on those, I think that would be really helpful. If the nonviolent resistance could be, small, quick actions where people, there, disperse, sends a reminder that there is resistance, empowers people to join in.
Until the opposition movement transitions to utilizing nonviolent strategies of resistance, Zunas believes the United States' decision to arm and fund the opposition was a poor strategic choice, rewarding the violent movement and sending the wrong message. In his opinion, the only role the international community should play in the conflict is supporting the nonviolent Syrian opposition through solidarity work.
I think in a whole number of ways, including passing on knowledge about the history and dynamics and of strategic nonviolent action, and there could be some practical support as well in terms of laptop computers and cell phones and other kinds of communication. And generally to make it clear that we support the nonviolent resistance, not out of some kind of geopolitical thing where our dictatorships are okay, but we'll help overthrow dictatorships we don't like, but out of a belief that dictatorship is wrong wherever it is and whomever they are allied with, and that they are basic universal human rights that should be respected, and that people who are struggling for these rights should be supported, again, regardless of the government's relations with the United States.
Zunas feels that the broad base of support for the opposition movement was shattered during the transition to violent strategies. This led many Syrians to hunker down in order to survive, instead of actively protesting and supporting the movement. Although he calls for a strategic return to nonviolence, he does not anticipate a sudden transition to Gandhi-like pacifism. Zunas believes a Syrian opposition movement leading a strategically nonviolent campaign against the regime would increase support, increase international sympathy, and increase rates of defection from the Syrian regime. This has the potential to finally bring substantial change in Syria. For War News Radio, I am Sabrina Merrill.
This is War News Radio. Over the past few years, War News Radio has done quite a bit of reporting about drone strikes. Usually, we call up activists, academics, and policymakers to discuss the effects of this largely secretive program targeting militants in Pakistan, Yemen, and beyond. We started to wonder, what do students like us think about drone strikes? Joining me today to discuss War News Radio's survey of students here at Swarthmore College is reporter Amy DiPiero. So, Amy, what exactly did you ask people, and what did you expect them to answer?
I'll admit that we came in with a particular narrative in mind. Like many foreign policy issues, we didn't think opinions on drone strikes split cleanly along party lines. On one hand, drone strikes have grown exponentially under President Obama, but the administration has also been extremely reluctant to even talk about them. The Republican Party is also pretty divided. The party's libertarian wing says strikes abroad threaten rights here at home, but other Republicans have expressed qualified support.
Simply put, these strikes have saved lives.
The president has a very real timeline, and we hope it's going to be very, very soon.
Are we so afraid of terrorists that we're willing to just throw out our rights and our freedoms?
I noticed that very few Republicans, if any, minded when George Bush was president about launching drone strikes.
So, in order, we just heard from two Democrats, President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry, as well as two Republicans, Senator Rand Paul and Senator John McCain.
Right, and keeping remarks like theirs in mind, our hypothesis was this. With the exception of civil libertarians like Rand Paul, Swarthmore's Republicans would be more likely than the college's Democrats to support drone strikes.
Well, maybe we should back up by saying that Swarthmore students aren't exactly representative of the rest of the country.
Yeah, it's fair to say that Swarthmore is pretty skewed to start. We're regarded by some as one of the most liberal liberal arts colleges in the U.S., and besides that, students here have a proud history of anti-war activism specifically. The school was founded in the 1860s by Quakers, pacifists by definition, and since then, Swarthmore has been home to conscientious objectors from the military, a special library devoted to peace movements, and a database of nonviolent actions all over the world. So, when we ran this study, we weren't really sure if Swarthmore's peaceful Quaker roots would rule the day or not.
So, true to the college's Quaker past, were Swarthmore students against drone strikes?
Okay, so you're missing an important snag in our plan here. I mentioned that Swarthmore students are pretty liberal. This isn't the University of Virginia, after all. So we weren't expecting a lot of conservatives in our survey to start with. But let's just say that after the first day of polling, only one person identified as a Republican. So we asked some of our conservative friends to take the survey, and we also posted the survey on the Facebook page for a group called the Swarthmore Conservative Society. In that sense, our poll isn't exactly random, but seeking a larger conservative sample has helped us to come to more significant conclusions now.
Well, what are your conclusions?
Our initial hypothesis was spot on. We found pretty conclusively that on average, Republicans support drone strikes more than Democrats. Republicans were also more likely than Democrats to prize national security issues over civil liberties. And sure enough, when you take out the libertarians in each party, those differences are even starker.
Yeah, but as we said earlier, Swarthmore is just not a representative sample for the rest of the country. Does your survey really reflect what people think about drone strikes?
Good question. We've compared our results to some national surveys. For example, a Pew Research poll earlier this year found that 69% of Republicans compared to only 59% of Democrats support drone strikes. Basically, it looks like Swarthmore students followed the same pattern, but with even lower support overall. Half of Republicans and under 20% of Democrats favored drone strikes. So yeah, it seems like Swarthmore's anti-war bias is alive and well. Another surprising result was how few students actually considered themselves well-informed about drone strikes in the first place. Comparing our results to a Gallup poll last winter, it looks like Swatties in both parties are less informed than the overall population. Less than half of Republicans and about a third of Democrats rated their knowledge about drone strikes higher than 5 on a 10-point scale. For a campus that prides itself on being globally aware, that's not very encouraging. And one last thing, just because I don't want to end on a downer. Just for the heck of it, we also asked respondents to rate their happiness before taking the poll. And it turns out that the majority of respondents, the Democrats that is, are slightly happier than their Republican peers. So maybe that's a confounding variable here? We just don't know yet.
Amy, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks for having me.
The team working on the Swarthmore drone survey includes reporters Tyler Welsh and Patrick Hahn, as well as their statistically minded friends, Chen Hei Wan and Thomas Kim. Zoe Sinistlar also contributed to this report. If you want to see some of the preliminary results from the survey, histograms, confidence intervals, the works, you can check them out on our website. Stay tuned later this year to find out whether there's a real difference between the two-party support for drones, or if the difference is just because Democrats are ever so slightly happier.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Nora Balin, Allison Raybar, Dylan Okabe-Jowda, Colin Smith, Will Sullivan, and Chloe Wittenberg. Our piece editors are Caroline Batten, Amy DiPiero, Sarah Morell, and Sadie Rittman. I'm Zoe Sinisklar.
And I'm Henry Zane. Until next time, thanks for listening.